Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, January 30th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt supervisors field comment on Redway old growth cutting. Multi-university collaboration maps community voices in the offshore wind frontier. And Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Concerns about the removal of old-growth redwood trees in Lower Redway dominated the public comment period of this week's Humboldt County Board of Supervisors meeting. Daniel Mintz reports.
Demands for protection of old-growth redwoods are being made following the recent removal of several large trees by a Lower Redway homeowner. Reactions to the tree cutting made up most of the public comment period of the January 27th Humboldt County Board of Supervisors meeting. The site of the tree removal is a recently purchased property on the corner of Briceland Road and Oak Ridge Drive in Lower Redway. As reported by the Redheaded Black Belt website on January 7th, the homeowner removed the trees because he believes they posed a falling limb hazard. CAL FIRE is the agency with authority to approve tree removal operations, and old-growth redwoods are subject to enhanced review. In a message urging people to lobby for tree protection, the Environmental Protection Information Center objects to an exemption for trees deemed to pose hazards, and the group warns that unless protection is enforced, quote, the old growth of Redway is not safe, and quote, nearly all of the trees in the community could be declared hazards and removed. Those who spoke at the supervisors' meeting also called for redwoods protection, including this Redway resident.
That person saying that they have to cut trees that have been there for thousands of years to protect a home they never lived in. They bought it and immediately took down trees that have been living there far longer than anyone that's on this board or any of us that are calling in right now. So I really want the board to take seriously that the planning department is not doing its duty. On your website, it says, this planning department is responsible for protecting public health, safety, and welfare. That includes our old-growth redwoods, which are a huge asset if all you care about is economics in our community. That's part of what people come to this area for. And if you don't want to live under a redwood tree, don't buy land under a redwood tree.
Richard Ganger of Forests Forever said there needs to be, quote, a real broad, comprehensive look at the situation in Lower Redway. And he added, an improved process is needed, quote, so these things don't arise and damage happens through exemption without looking at all the alternatives to adequately protect the old growth in that area. Andrew Morris, owner of Briceland Vineyards, vouched for better management of old growth redwoods.
What I do feel that we need is a good process to manage how decisions about these old trees are made. And there needs to be some checks and balances and to remove the profit incentive. So if somebody does have to trim trees or remove trees for real safety issues, which are determined by more than one person, maybe a panel of experts, maybe there's an option to be able to challenge a determination before it goes through all the way, before it can't be revoked. But there needs to be a process, and there needs to be an elimination of the profit motive, because somebody shouldn't be able to just buy a house at a cheap price based on the fact that the trees can't be taken, and then take the trees.
But Southern Humboldt resident Thomas Mulder, who often comments on property rights issues, said CAL FIRE's management is definitive, and he advised against going beyond it.
About the trees thing, I read that article, and I appreciate the planning director's understanding. That's outside the scope of the planning department. That rests in the hands of CAL FIRE. totally legal. They didn't scapegoat anything. But that's another young person. The kid went to school with my daughter, same age. And you guys are trying to make him a criminal and drive him out. It's sad, you know? Promote the youth in our community to do great things because we teach them to do great things rather than drive them out of our community.
Supervisors generally don't respond to public comment on non-agenda items, and there was no board discussion on the issues raised. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
A multi-institutional study involving Oregon State University, Cal Poly Humboldt, and several others is researching how local communities perceive the development of offshore wind. KMUD talked with three of the researchers. Julia Bingham is a marine social scientist focused on community-partnered research and is a postdoctoral scholar at Oregon State University, based in the Department of Public Policy and is affiliated with the Pacific Marine Energy Center. Tanner Etherton is an economic analyst at the Schatz Energy Center of Cal Poly Humboldt and is an extension specialist with the California Sea Grant. And Lauren Hart, a graduate research assistant with the Schatz Energy Research Center and a master's student in the Environmental Systems Program at Cal Poly Humboldt. Bingham started by explaining which universities are participating in this research and where they are focusing their energy.
The project is a collaboration between Oregon State, Cal Poly Humboldt, University of Washington, University of Maine, and University of Delaware. So multi-institution effort. Oregon State is the lead university on the project, and each affiliated university has their own focus on either specific communities or portions of the project. We're really interested in understanding community perspectives around anticipated impacts from offshore wind, anticipated potential benefits, and how communities understand and view policy tools like community benefit agreements as a potential way to ensure benefits or mitigate impacts from offshore wind. The interviews have prioritized folks who are local community leads, either through an official position or unofficially as the community members recognize them, and play a role in offshore wind discussions and potentially would be leads in a community benefit agreement. And Lauren and Tanner can talk about what that specifically looked like for identifying folks in Humboldt.
Etherton explained that Cal Poly Humboldt focused on identifying potential people to interview through different groups and networking. They then grouped them into specific categories to ensure a diverse set of interviewees. Hart went into more detail about Cal Poly Humboldt's approach to the interviews and surveys that they were conducting.
The interviews that we ended up conducting, like Tanner said, the Schatz Center has a lot of really great pre-existing relationships with community leaders who are doing work and engagement in offshore wind out here. And a lot of our focus was on either groups or people who aren't traditionally represented in engagement processes like these, or who had been identified as potentially being impacted by the project. So we've talked to people in fisheries, we've talked to tribal liaisons, we've talked to community representatives who are near the heavy lift marine terminal development site. We've talked to people in research, different like local government leaders, people involved in the offshore wind planning and development process. So we tried to get a really large breadth of different people we're talking to, and then get a couple of different perspectives from each of those different categories. And yeah, the interviews are really about hearing more like depth and values about the experiences that are shaping how people are thinking about offshore wind here. Humboldt is a really unique place, and the people here care really deeply about their community and the outcome of offshore wind development. But I can tell you a little bit about the surveys too. So we went out and we did household surveys in Eureka and Samoa, and we used a drop-off pickup method. So we were out there for 9 or 10 days, knocking on people's door 1 or 2 times a day.
Etherton shared some of the preliminary results they had found.
While there is a lot of apprehension and concern about the potential risks of offshore wind, people do see that there are a lot of potential benefits, particularly economically. But when we look at the percentage of people who stated that they support leasing space off the shore of California for offshore wind development, you have roughly 37% in support, and then about half that who are opposed, and then the remainder, a substantial amount, who are just unsure. And there's, you know, a lot of differences across those groups, but in a lot of ways, they perceive the same sort of potential risks, you know, mainly towards tribes, cultural resources, the environment, marine environments, and then the same sort of benefits, really economic jobs, opportunities, electricity reliability and resilience. Across the survey, respondents seem to more strongly believe that community benefit agreements should be mandatory for these sort of projects. And then also they want this electricity and this energy to stay local. Once it starts, is perceived or described as potentially going to other states, which it's not necessarily, but if you describe it in that way, you do see that people become more opposed. Even if it goes to city centers in California, there's kind of a more mixed result, but they believe that energy is electricity staying in California, we typically see them become more supportive of the project. And that's just a few. I mean, there's a lot of survey questions. It was supposed to take respondents like 15 to 20 minutes to complete. And there's some context given about, you know, what offshore wind is and that there is potentially development happening off the coast. But besides that, participants weren't really given that much information. So it's just kind of based on what they knew at the time of responding. And this was done back in May. So last summer. Hasn't been a ton of major developments to offshore wind since then, but this is after the federal administration has come out pretty strongly in opposition to the industry.
Hart stated they had already done a presentation for the community a couple weeks ago where they shared their early findings.
We got some really good feedback after the session and during the session. And so one of our next steps that we'd like to take is finishing our analysis, first of all, and then finding a way to provide a toolkit to the community so that they feel more prepared and empowered to participate in planning and decision-making processes. So that's one of our big deliverables that we want to put out.
Etherton added that there is more work to be done, especially with surveying the peninsula, which had not been a priority earlier.
And one thing that was identified was potentially to need to do additional survey efforts out on the peninsula to capture a community that was unfortunately left out, and specifically a affordable housing development out there with hundreds of residents who, due to the way that the survey area was identified and the surveys were sampled, we use GIS data that just didn't include those townhomes. So we've come up with a way to include them as part of the project. So we're excited to engage more there. And then as Lauren said, yeah, planning on doing, pushing out those presentations, the preliminary analysis that we presented at the community meeting.
Bingham expanded on the project, connecting the process to all other locations.
But the broader project, we're kind of on a similar time frame for the other states as well. I've just finished kind of inputting and cleaning and doing preliminary analysis for the surveys for other communities as well. Lauren is part of a group of students I'm working with across the universities to analyze the interview data. So we're moving forward with that. Oregon and California were a little further ahead working through some of the data, so we're hopeful that we'll finish this analysis and start being able to have additional presentations out and potentially these toolkits, hopefully as early as end of spring, maybe the summer. And we're also doing another survey edition in Oregon too, similar to the Samoa edition, just to make sure that we're capturing important communities for the conversation and including them in the data that we're working with when they were otherwise for various reasons missed in the initial sample. So we're just trying to make sure we're doing our due diligence there, and we're really prioritizing communicating out to the communities and giving useful products. You know, we're planning publications too on the academic side, but the priority is making sure that this work gets turned around and benefits the communities that we've been working with and spending time in.
Etherton shared his thoughts on the different results in the communities, seeing how priorities change depending on location and need.
It's been interesting too to see the results across the different communities on the West Coast. And so, you know, I mentioned that in Humboldt, we have a larger share of people who are in support of offshore wind development than who are opposed. But then we see the opposite in Coos Bay and Westport, Washington, where there seems to be less support and more opposition. And there are some differences in demographics, you know, mainly that there's a greater portion of Democrats compared to Republicans in the Humboldt area, or at least in our sample, versus Westport and Coos Bay. And then also some other factors, you know, related to connection to the sea and the industries that respondents are in. So, you know, there seems to be a greater, a stronger fishing industry in the Washington and Oregon group. And then it's also built connections for me as a researcher and the other work I do with, you know, community and partners in Coos Bay. And we've started conversations and held public meetings to connect our community with the community up there. Cause you know, there's similar concerns and not just about this project, but port development in general. And, you know, a lot of the same values that we hold here in Humboldt, they seem to share across the border.
Hard to summarize the research so far, finding the commonalities between the differing perspectives.
One of the bigger takeaways from the interview analysis that we've done so far is that people aren't necessarily in opposition to offshore wind or renewable energy. They just want to see large industry done in a different way here than it has been before with the boom-bust industries.
While the final report and community toolkit are being completed, there are still a lot of conversations that need to be done. And Ray Hamill with the Weekly Sports Report.
The Arcata girls and McKinleyville boys were crowned Big Five champions in basketball this week as both teams continued their impressive seasons. Hello and welcome to this week's KModa News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Big Five champions in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories in what was a busy week here on the North Coast, including all the latest high school and college basketball news, why it was a tough week for one local program, news of a big return at College of the Redwoods, a look ahead to a big weekend for one Cal Poly Humboldt team, how the local sports community plans to celebrate National Girls and Women in Sports Day, and why March the 8th will be a big day for the local running community. But first up, the Arcata girls basketball team celebrated senior night on Tuesday with a league championship. After honoring a class of seven seniors before their game with the Fortuna Huskies, a group that includes reigning co-MVPs of the Big Five, Tay and May Wolfert, the Tigers took care of business on the court with a 65-49 win. The victory, which was the team's eighth straight, lifted the Tigers to 6-0 in conference play and moved them three wins clear of the chasing pack with just two games remaining. The championship is the second straight for the school. The Tigers had clinched at least a share of the title over the weekend when it was announced the Eureka Loggers would have to forfeit two games from earlier in the year because they had fielded an ineligible player, including a Big Five game against McKinleyville. That dropped the Loggers from 3-2 in conference play to 2-3. The news capped a disappointing few days for the Eureka team, which suffered back-to-back conference losses to Arcata and McKinleyville, the latter coming in overtime on Friday night. The Arcata girls, however, made sure they would not have to share the title with Tuesday's win, which was the team's 15th straight in conference play dating back to February of 2024. Also in Big Five girls action on Tuesday, Del Norte got an important 51-38 win over McKinleyville to improve to 3-3 in conference play and take over sole possession of second in the standings. The top three teams in the final conference standings will advance to the upcoming HDNL postseason Dick Nicolai tournament, which is always one of the highlights of the local sporting year. In Little Four girls basketball last weekend, the St. Bernard's girls continued their march towards a conference title with a 69-39 win at Hoopa, while Ferndale got the better of South Fork 45-3. The SB girls, however, would drop a non-conference game in overtime to their crosstown rivals on Saturday night, falling 54-52 to Eureka. In local boys basketball, the McKinleyville Panthers clinched at least a share of the Big Five title with a 49-42 win over Del Norte on Wednesday. The championship is the second in 3 years for McKinleyville, which improved to 6-0 in the Big Five. The Panthers, who also won last year's Dick Nicolai tournament, can claim the Big Five title outright with a win in either of their final two conference games or an Arcata loss in either of their final two games. The Tigers continued their late season surge with a 64-36 win at Fortuna on Wednesday, which was their third straight in the Big Five and lifted them to 4-2. Eureka, which had a bye in conference play this week, is third in the Big Five with a record of 2-3, followed by Del Norte at 2-4 and Fortuna at 0-5. Big Five action continues on Friday night with a pivotal game in Crescent City between Del Norte and Eureka, with the winner taking over third in the standings and moving into pole position for the Big Five's third and final Dick Nicolai tournament Bert. In Little Four boys basketball, the St. Bernard's Crusaders inched closer to the conference championship with an 81-45 win over Hoopa last Friday, improving to 3-0 in conference and two wins clear of the chasing pack with three games remaining. The SB boys can clinch at least a share of the title with a win at home against Ferndale on Friday night. Also in the Little Four last Friday, South Fork defeated Ferndale 67-53 to leave both schools 1-2 in conference and in a three-way tie with Hoopa for second. All three teams remain in the hunt for the second and third Little Four Dick Nicolai tournament berths. Hoopa hosts South Fork in Little Four action on Friday night. In college basketball, meanwhile, it was a good weekend for all four local teams. The College of the Redwoods men's and women's teams played at Lassen and won. The CR men prevailed 93-63, just 2 days after losing 78-65 at Feather River, improving to 4-1 in the Golden Valley Conference and keeping pressure on conference leader Feather River, which is 5-0. The CR women posted their third straight win with an 80-56 victory, improving to 4-1 in conference and remaining just one win behind GVC leaders Butte, which is 5-0. The Cal Poly Humboldt teams both also enjoyed impressive weekends. The Humboldt men beat Cal Poly Pomona and Cal State San Bernardino to go to 9-3 in conference play, and they remain tied for second in the standings with Dominguez Hills, while the Humboldt women also beat Pomona and San Bernardino and improved to 10-2 in conference play, remaining third in the standings, just one win behind co-leaders Pomona and Chico State. In local college softball, College of the Redwoods enjoyed a successful return to action at the David Hawk Wilder Memorial Tournament in Glendale last weekend. The Corsairs, who were playing for the first time in 2 years, after having to cancel their 2025 season due to a shortage of players, lost just one of four games, finishing 2-1-1. This weekend also sees the Cal Poly Humboldt softball team begin the 2026 season at the Concordia Kickoff in Irvine, with four games over 2 days. The CR baseball team, meanwhile, began the new season last weekend with a three-game series at Mendocino College, with the Eagles taking all three games by scores of 8-4, 13-9, and 11-1. Switching gears, National Girls and Women's in Sports Day will take place on Wednesday of next week, and the day will be celebrated here on the North Coast with a special event at College of the Redwoods. For the second straight year, Del Norte High School senior Bliss Blackburn is organizing a local event to highlight the importance of participating in sports for young girls. The event, which will take place from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m, is free for any girls in 6th through 8th grade in Humboldt and Del Norte counties, and will include a guest speaker, current topics and games, as well as a free lunch and free sweatshirt for all participants. And rounding out another busy week in local sports news, the 47th annual Foggy Bottom Milk Run will take place in Ferndale on Sunday, March the 11th. The popular annual event will feature 2-mile, 4-mile and 10-mile races for all ages. And that's this week's KMODA News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. There was a hung jury in Rapid City, South Dakota, Wednesday in a case against founder and CEO of the Native-led organization Indian Collective, Nick Tilson. After 3 days of hearings, a mistrial was declared. Tilson's accused of assaulting a police officer in 2022. He's facing charges for aggravated and simple assault on a law enforcement officer and obstruction of a law enforcement officer, facing 26 years in prison. In a statement, Tilson said he's grateful for everyone who stood with him, adding, "The fight's not over." The state has 45 days to notify the judge of intentions to retry the case. The rate of Alaskans dying from drug overdoses declined by 5% in 2024 compared to the year before, including a decline for Indigenous Alaskans, according to a recent state report. That's a welcome reduction after the state saw its highest number of overdose deaths on record in 2023. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports.
The United States has seen significant declines in overdose death rates over the past 2 years. And now Alaska could be seeing the start of a similar reduction, according to experts. Teresa Walton is a manager for Alaska's Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention. She says the decline is good news for the state, even though the state's reduction is much smaller than the national one.
I think we're on the right track.
And she says the decline is likely partly due to state efforts. The report notes the state distributed 45,000 naloxone kits in 2024 with fentanyl test strips. The state has mobile crisis teams in Anchorage, Matsu, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Juneau. And Alaska has expanded access to medication-assisted treatment, recovery housing, and therapeutic courts. But Welton says there's more work to do, and it will require a collaborative effort among the state, tribal organizations, and local communities.
Even with nationally, everybody is trying to look for that magic fix to start decreasing these deaths. And I think it's just a combination of supporting communities to address these issues at a community level and emphasizing prevention.
She says it's expensive to build treatment facilities, so increasing access to buprenorphine and other medications for substance use disorders could help prevent overdose deaths. She says Alaska struggles with having enough resources to provide treatment for substance use disorders, partly because rural residents must travel for treatment. According to the report, fentanyl is Alaska's deadliest drug. It contributed to more than 70% of overdose deaths in 2024. But Welton says it's crucial to note that many of the overdoses with fentanyl also included one or more other substances. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
This week, the U.S. Mint released this year's Native American $1 coin featuring Polly Cooper. The Oneida Indian Nation says she's recognized for bringing food and supplies to her homelands in upstate New York to Army troops at Valley Forge during the winter of 1777-78. The tribe says recognizing Cooper and the tribe as allies is timely as the U.S. prepares to observe the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The coin depicts Polly Cooper with General George Washington as she holds a basket of corn. Cooper stayed at the camp through the winter and taught soldiers how to prepare corn and cook for them in harsh conditions to help ensure their survival. Oneida Indian Nation Representative Ray Halbritter says the Oneida people became America's first allies on some of the bloodiest battlefields of the Revolutionary War. According to the tribe, nation members continue the legacy of military service, serving in every major American conflict since then. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Michael McCaskill. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Ray Hamill, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.